You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, ChristianHumanist.org.
This is the scene of the crime. A crime of passion, filmed in a way you have never seen before. And as no one else would dare attempt, but the screen's master of suspense, the producer-director who shocked the world with Psycho.
Well, hello, everybody. This is the City of Man podcast, and I am Edward Song, an associate professor of philosophy at Westmont College in Santa Barbara, California. This is an unusual episode for us, as it is Christian Humanist Halloween crossover week, where all of the hosts of the various Christian Humanist Radio Network shows cross over to other people's podcasts. In past years, we have discussed various episodes of The Twilight Zone, or last year, the movies of Boris Karloff. This year, we are tackling Alfred Hitchcock movies. And more specifically, today, we'll be talking about that Hitchcock classic, Rear Window. Coy O'Neill is not with me today. Instead, I am joined by Jay Eldred, a frequent contributor to Danny Anderson's Sectarian Review, as well as a number of other Christian Humanist radio shows. Jay is a history teacher at Calvary Baptist Church School in Newburgh, North Carolina. Welcome to you, Jay.
Good to be here.
I am also joined by Michael Farmer, one of the three persons of the Holy Trinity that is the Christian Humanist podcast. He is an assistant professor of English at Crown College outside of Minneapolis, Minnesota. So which one are you, Michael? Are you the Father, Son, or the Holy Ghost?
Is there a way to answer that that doesn't end in some sort of heresy, Ed? Sounds like trouble.
I just ask the questions here, Michael. I don't answer them.
I don't answer them either, as it turns out.
Yeah, we should make that an online poll. In any case, I don't think I've been on a show with either of you, so it's good to see your faces and to hear your voices.
Yeah, thanks for having us on, Ed.
Yeah, it's great to be with you. And Jay, I think you're a runner. That's something that we have in common.
Yes, I do run. I'm training for my fourth marathon.
Awesome. Where are you running it?
The Outer Banks.
Oh, great.
So Nag's Head, Manteo. Great.
I ran a marathon this weekend, in fact.
Great.
You and I, we should start the Christian Humanist Running Podcast is what we should do. Well, anyways, so today we will be discussing Rear Window, Alfred Hitchcock's classic 1954 thriller, a claustrophobic study of privacy, strangers, loneliness, and voyeurism. And just by way of a quick summary of the movie, Jimmy Stewart plays L.B. Jeffries, or Jeff, to his friends. He is an adventuring photographer who has been confined to his small Greenwich Village apartment after an accident at a car race has left him wheelchair-bound, his whole left leg bound in a cast. Jeff's main source of diversion comes from spying on the life in the courtyard outside his rear window and the apartment buildings around it. His only visitors are his plain-speaking nurse, Stella, and his girlfriend, Lisa, played by Grace Kelly. Lisa is the platonic ideal of a New York City socialite. She is young, wealthy, glamorous, preternaturally beautiful, and well-connected. She wants to marry Jeff, but he worries that she is too perfect. Their worlds are just too different. The apartment buildings outside of Jeff's window are teeming with the quiet dramas of domestic life. A pianist struggles with a composition. A young dancer manages her multiple suitors. A single older woman, Miss Lonely Hearts, wrestles with her loneliness. And most important, Lars Thorwald, a middle-aged jewelry salesman, takes care of and occasionally argues with his bedridden wife. One night, Jeff is awoken by a scream and the sound of crashing glass. He later sees Thorwald suspiciously leaving his apartment multiple times with his sample case in hand. Jeff comes to believe that Thorwald has murdered his wife, cut her into pieces to destroy any evidence of a murder in the hopes of running off with his mistress. Jeff convinces Lisa and Stella of his theory, and the three of them, along with an old friend of Jeff's who is a police detective, endeavor to prove Thorwald's guilt. All of this climaxes in the final act when Thorwald discovers that Jeff has been spying on him from across the courtyard and comes to his apartment in the middle of the night when Jeff is alone. Jeff fends him off by blinding him multiple times with the flash of his camera. They struggle. Jeff is thrown out of his window, but his fall is broken by his friends who arrive in the nick of time with the police. Thorwald confesses, and the movie closes with Jeff, now with both legs in a cast, along with Lisa, clearly reconciled to each other and plotting a future together. So a super classic Hitchcock movie, one of the landmarks of American mainstream cinema. And just a kind of a quick meta question to kick things off. Do you guys like horror movies or scare? I guess this isn't exactly a horror movie, but do you like thrillers and scary movies?
I like thrillers more so than horror. Like, I particularly like The Shining, things that are slow, make you think mm-hmm. without showing too much. Straight out gore just isn't mm-hmm. my thing.
I couldn't do The Shining in a million years. I watched that when I was 12 years old and I didn't sleep for 2 weeks. I still have nightmares about The Shining. But I like kind of mildly scary movies. Nothing in Hitchcock really gives me too many nightmares, except maybe the shower scene in Psycho. I like to watch thrillers on planes where nobody can sneak up on me.
Yeah, I kind of it's interesting to me that that you described The Shining as a thriller, not a horror movie. Like, I've never seen. I guess I've seen snippets of The Shining, but I don't know that I could watch that. For me, my poison when I was growing up was seeing Poltergeist with my dad. When I was way too young to be watching Poltergeist, and I couldn't sleep. I couldn't sleep for the next year.
I remember watching. I had tuned into TBS to watch Captain Planet. This must have been 1991. And it had been delayed for some reason, and the last half hour of Poltergeist was airing instead, and it wasn't pretty.
Yeah, clowns. Clowns and TVs with static, just those thoughts.
Yeah, I'm terrified somebody next year is going to suggest we do Stephen King movies or something, because I just don't know that
that I'll be participating in that.
I've never seen one except The Shining, which I will never see again.
Stephen King, that is a good suggestion for next year.
No, it's not, Ed.
I went to see Misery. I saw Misery when I was in college, and a friend had asked me to go, and I was like, yeah, sure, I'll go see Misery with you. And we're sitting in it, and maybe the opening scene starts running, and I think to myself, oh my God, this is, what am I doing here? This is a Stephen King movie. How did I end up here?
I can't leave for 2 hours.
Yeah.
I'm gonna see a lot of broken legs before then.
Yeah, that's right. We could do next year, it's gonna be movies with people in casts. That's gonna be the theme.
Yeah. We've already done Rear Window, so that's not gonna work.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing to me. I really do love Hitchcockian thrillers like Rear Window, or does Vertigo count? I guess Vertigo counts.
Yeah, Vertigo's a thriller.
And The Birds counts.
Victoria is so afraid of the birds, she won't watch it. She was afraid she'd end up on a show with the birds.
But, yeah, that just the natural experience of shock that draws so many people to movies like that, that's a little bit do not compute, which is why I was super happy to sign up for Rear Window.
Which is not terribly scary, right? There's a couple of tense scenes, but mostly it's just a good movie, a really good mm-hmm. movie.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And your way, Jay, of describing the thriller as being, I can't remember exactly what you said, but
I always think, like, my definition of a thriller, comparing thriller to horror, a thriller is more dependent on scene and on circumstance, and it's more of a mental thing. Whereas to me, horror is, well, here's this guy and he's going to, you know, kill 50 campers and you're going to see all the blood and gore and everything like that.
So, Jay, what do you make of the movies we watched last year, like Dracula and Frankenstein? Are those horror movies or thrillers?
Well, it also depends on which version we're talking about.
Sure.
Especially with Frankenstein, isn't that one of the most most made movies.
Yeah, there's a lot of versions.
So for example, one of the more recent ones, Dracula Untold, that's kind of not either. That's more, I don't know, action.
What about Dracula Dead and Loving It?
Oh, well, that's a different story. I don't know. It's been so long since I've seen that one.
Anyway, I think the lines get blurry over time because part of what defines a horror movie is that it's horrifying. And as we get more and more used to horror movies, they end up being not so scary. I mean, that's what struck me. I'd never seen any of those movies we talked about last year. I watched all of them so that I could follow the episodes. And none of them, other than Invisible Man, which nobody even talked about, none of them were all that scary. And I know at the time they were considered just terrifying. So I think over time, things that were horror end up sliding into comedy or drama, or not comedy, a thriller or drama or something else. Sometimes comedy.
Yeah, I was going to say, hopefully they don't end up as comedy.
Yeah, unintentional comedy, maybe.
Your description of thriller, Jay, is like a perfect description of the construction of Rear Window.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's never any gore in it. And it really is this slow psychological thriller. You suspect Thorwald, but at the same time, Hitchcock puts these little things that at least cause just a little bit of doubt about whether Jimmy Stewart is right.
Right.
He gives. There are lots of little wrong turns in there, and it is this slow and steady buildup mm-hmm. to that great climactic scene, you know, in his darkened apartment.
And, well, and then every time it moves forward, it slides back just a little bit. So yeah, the movie is much longer than I remember it being. I've seen it, I don't know, 5 or 6 times, and there's more to it than I remembered.
Mm-hmm. At some point we should mention that, you know, there is a dog in this movie, and the dog does not make it through the movie. So
that's yes. The closest thing to gore we get.
We'll save you a trip to doesthedogdie.com.
Yes, the dog dies. Does it have it? It doesn't even have a name, does it?
Oh,
you know, I don't know about that.
I don't
actually.
Know. I don't know.
And you know. The death of the dog, I don't know if it makes sense to sort of jump around a little bit, but since we're talking about the dog. I mean, the death of the dog elicits one of the longer sort of set piece monologues
mm-hmm.
that gets at some of the themes. So
one of the few long speaking parts from anyone who's not in the central cast.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Where she complains about the heartlessness of her neighbors and how no one cares, and the dog was the only one who cared about people.
Proving that people have been talking about the breakdown of the city for a very long time.
Mm-hmm. So you, Michael, you mentioned that that was one of the few extended speaking parts by anybody but one of the main characters. In some ways, one of the most important characters in it is just that courtyard and the surrounding apartment buildings.
Absolutely. This is an emplaced movie, as we might say.
Yeah, it takes place entirely in his apartment. I mean, you know, I'm actually thinking it's shot entirely from his apartment, right? Obviously,
yeah.
Things happen in other people's apartment, but it's always shot from the perspective of Jeff's apartment.
Until the very end when Thorwald is hanging him out the window.
Then you
see the view from the courtyard.
From the courtyard, that's right.
Yeah, for the most part, I looked at it as for the most part, we were almost the window. Either we were looking in at Jimmy Stewart or we were looking out at the courtyard.
I like that. And then the opening scene, of course, is the window. So when the credits are rolling, the entire scene is just a still shot of the window with the blinds going up slowly. So I like that reading that we're the window.
Mm. Yeah, but that set is so glorious
yes.
and such a major factor in the movie. Apparently they had to totally tear apart the Paramount building in order
yeah.
to build it. Like they had to rip out the main floor. So the basement is the courtyard.
Right.
So that they can look down on that. And then they built this really elaborate set. Though I have to say when they're first doing the opening shots, it sort of looks like they're shooting on the Sesame Street lot.
Yeah, a little bit. You're right. I mean, one soundstage version of Manhattan is as good as another, I suppose.
There's just something about, I don't know. So it was made in
1954.
And there's just something about, that's just like sort of classically New York Greenwich Village.
I think it's based on a real courtyard in Greenwich Village, although not where they say it is. I can't remember the actual address, but it's not on the address that they give in the movie when he calls the police.
Right.
But they do, I mean, they rebuild this entire city block, essentially. And obviously they do it in such a way that human beings can walk around in the apartments across the street. So there's probably a little bit of forced perspective, but not that much. I mean, this is a real four-story building made inside of another building. And yet, I think the light looks pretty good as far as artificial light in the soundstage.
Yeah, apparently I think they used every light that Paramount owned that wasn't being used by another movie in production to make that work.
It was worth it.
And at one, and at one point I think the lights were so hot that it set off the sprinkler system.
Well, that works too, because this is one of the sweatiest movies ever made. It's so hot in this movie.
Well, and that's necessary for the plot as well. There has to be a reason for the window to be there and be open.
Right. And everybody's windows, yeah.
Yeah, so it takes place, I guess, in a sweltering summer. There are people sleeping out on fire escapes. Like, one of the opening shots is of Jimmy Stewart's sweating forehead.
Yeah.
And so that little bit of texture.
It's 90 degrees in the morning. Like, it must be 9 a.m., and it's already 90. I can't imagine how hot that is. Without air conditioning, my goodness.
Yeah. Yeah.
I love the detail of the people sleeping out on the fire escape, which is, of course, something people really did slash do in cities before there's air conditioning. And my favorite little thing, though, is that they have hung the alarm clock from the fire escape on a rope so that they don't knock it off in the middle of the night. That's such a wonderful little detail.
Yeah, so I one of the major themes of the movie, I guess, is just like these quiet, well, I mean, these quiet but very significant little domestic dramas that are going on in everybody's life.
Yeah.
And, you know, just the ability to shoot into all of these different apartments, it looks like one of those great, gosh, now who was the name? I had one of his books, but there was a famous children's author who did these books of just city scenes. And I always found them to be so dramatic and appealing just because they were, you know, it was these really vivid, detailed depictions of the busyness of city life, and you're always just sort of wondering, oh, you know, where is that person going, or what's that person's life like?
You're not talking about Richard Scarry, are you?
Well, no. So I, so
okay,
I do.
So
I,
that's where
Richard
my mind
Scarry
went
is. I love Richard Scarry for in some ways the exact same reason, but that's not specific. These are a little bit more finely drawn and less cartoony. But yeah, Richard Scarry too. Love those.
Did you grow up in a city, Ed?
I grew up in a medium-sized city, I guess.
Okay. I'm just curious. We have a theory over on Before They Were Live that when you don't grow up in a city, when you grow up in the suburbs, the city is this place of enormous enchantment. And so many children's books are set in the city, of course, and so that's what that made me think of. And this movie, I saw it the first time when I was in college, and all I could think of was moving to this soundstage Greenwich Village. The real Greenwich Village you're kind of priced out of, I'm afraid.
These days, at least.
I grew up in middle of nowhere Pennsylvania, and the city was never appealing.
Well, for some people anyway.
Yeah.
Correct.
But you get these great little glimpses, and just these people are living very ordinary lives that seem mundane in some ways, but then he's also just giving you a little bit, he's peeling it away a little bit, and so you see that it's anything but mundane, it's so torrid. And, you know, so the most dramatic of these, obviously, is Miss Lonely Hearts. Well, that's what Jeff calls her anyway. But she is what I take to be a middle-aged single woman. And in some ways, one of the most dramatic scenes in the movie is, so the scene where he sees her and she's setting this, she clearly has a fancy dinner date planned and she has the table set and there are candles and wine and she's getting all ready. She walks through the door and then you realize that it's all a fantasy.
Oh, it's so brutal.
It's heartbreaking.
Well, and then the payoff later in the movie where she does have the date, brings the guy home and he, I mean, let's not mince words, he sexually assaults her. and then she's going to kill herself. I mean, the humanity Hitchcock packs into that, you know, very minor part. She has no particular role in the movie except that we have to call the cops on somebody. And that's how the cops get there. But I mean, that's a really moving, beautiful plot. Of course, her life is saved by hearing the music from the composer.
Yeah, a colleague of mine, we were talking about the movie just before we started recording, and she sort of noted that it's kind of proto Me Too, this movie.
Mm-hmm. It really is.
And there's a kind of a feminist theme that runs through it. I mean, speaking of timeliness as well, like, you know, hacked up bodies is also kind of, bone saws and such is also in the news. So a strangely timely movie for mid to late October.
It's true, yeah. Yeah, so, I mean, the gender politics in this movie are very interesting. Jeff doesn't want to marry Lisa because he feels like she's essentially not masculine enough, wouldn't you say? That the problem is she wants to wear pretty dresses, and he doesn't think that she can run with the bulls in Pamplona or whatever it is he wants her to do.
Yeah. And then the only time in the movie that I recall that we actually get a close-up of Jeff is when, what's her name, Lisa? Is it Lisa or Lisa?
He says Lisa. Everybody else seems to say Lisa.
Okay. I wasn't sure. Is when she's acting not like herself, when she's acting like Jeff wants him to, that's when you get the close-up of Jeff, and that's when he shows her the most, I guess we'll call it appreciation, is when she's not acting like herself but acting like what he wants her to be.
Or to read that more charitably, she's acting in a way that she always had in her, and that because of her upper crust life, she never really had the time to the opportunity to exercise. I mean, absolutely, he wants her to be something she is currently not. But the impression I get watching the movie is that she enjoys that to a certain degree.
I was okay to a certain degree, because I would have agreed with you if it weren't for the very last shot of the film.
Right, where she puts down the adventure magazine and goes back to Harper's Bazaar.
Yeah, so I kind of read that as being, she's bridged the world. She's bridged the worlds. And in some ways, that's a real triumph for her, right? Because she doesn't totally dissolve into Jeff's world of adventure.
Yep.
It's like she can play that game, but at the same time, she's still in, you know, the uber New York City socialite.
She's still Grace Kelly.
Yeah.
This is Grace Kelly at her Grace Kelly-est.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I like that character, because she always seems to have one up on him. She's smarter than he is. And I think deep down he knows that, but he can't justify it to himself. She outwits him. She's braver than him. I don't think he would have gone over to that apartment, and he's certainly more worried about her than she is about herself. So I find her in a film canon, Hitchcock's canon, where there aren't a lot of women who are both powerful and smart and good, I think Rear Window stands out.
Yeah, to me, one of the nicest scenes in the movie is when she comes over after Jeff has witnessed the murder, and he is unpacking his whole theory, and she's skeptical about it. But then, and I can't even remember what Jeff had said, but then all of a sudden, she's kind of convinced, or she tips over to the other side, and you can see this natural curiosity and interest spring up out of her for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
And it's this really kind of delicious moment of, like, discovery. And then through that, you see, like, all of these gifts of her intelligence and fearlessness. The climax of the movie is her sneaking into Thorwald's apartment. It's such a great scene. She climbs up the fire escape, sort of jumps across from the fire escape to an open window. It's a great scene.
Yeah, who knew Grace Kelly had it in her? Hitchcock, I suppose.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and I'm not, do you all know her filmography well? She certainly has an interesting story as a Hollywood actress who became the Princess of Monaco.
I know her general story arc, but as far as specific films, I don't know that.
Well, she's quite good in this movie. I'm it's not like she doesn't get her due. She's one of the great stars of classic Hollywood, but her performance is really central to this movie. you can't imagine anybody but her being Lisa, just like you can't imagine anybody but Jimmy Stewart being Jeff.
Right.
So that kind of feminism or proto-feminism is a big theme that runs through the movie. Voyeurism is another. Some of the other longer set pieces come out of the mouth of Jeff's nurse. The insurance company sends him a nurse, Stella, who's a great character as well.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Tough as nails. So, you know, she isn't a stereotypical woman. She's tough as nails and plain spoken and morbid. She's always criticizing Jeff and telling him his business. But, you know, the opening scene with her is her coming in and criticizing him for being a peeping Tom, and she makes some crack about how in the old days they put a spike in your eye or something like that.
Yeah.
But there is this big theme of voyeurism. Voyeurism is such a funny theme. I think in some ways my first response when I was thinking about this is that I don't think I'm kind of tempted by voyeurism or to kind of listen in and see what's going on. Then I wasn't really sure. Do you all find that instinct to peep or eavesdrop? I don't necessarily mean in a perverse way, but if you're at the coffee shop and you hear a conversation, or I mean, do you feel a temptation to kind of dip into the things that are going on?
Well, if someone's talking loud enough for me to hear their conversation, sometimes it's impossible not to. Mm-hmm. But with this particular film, it reminded me not necessarily of someone tempted by voyeurism, but maybe someone who fell into it just because of boredom. Mm-hmm. It actually reminded me of my grandmother, who we would go and see her, and she would be able to tell us what all the neighbors are doing because she didn't really have anything else to do but look out her window. So-and-so was up till 2 o'clock because I saw the light on, but I wasn't mm-hmm. spying, you know. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure how much was because he genuinely wanted to know what was going on, or the fact that it's the middle of summer in Greenwich Village with a broken leg.
Oh, and he certainly seems to be enjoying himself. He makes up names for the people. He is clearly following their exploits. So he may have fallen into it, but it's not like they dragged him kicking and screaming.
Mm-hmm. And interestingly, I mean, he is a photographer.
Right.
Right?
Right.
He could have been anything, but he was a photographer.
And an action photographer. So he's used to going where there's a story to be told. And it, I mean, mm-hmm. it's no surprise that everybody in the courtyard has their own story. One we forgot to mention is the, and this really works with the voyeurism, is the newlywed couple whose window shade is perpetually down because they're doing what newlyweds do. And then every time it comes up, the wife calls the husband back into the bedroom. That's a wonderful detail, but also, I mean, that's kind of what you think of when you think of voyeurism, right? He's watching these people in the throes of passion.
Yeah, miss one of the very, very first scenes. I was a little bit shocked by this, actually, given the standards of 1954. But one of the very first shots in the movie, as the camera is kind of panning around into various people's apartments, you see Miss Torso. You know, the woman who Jeff calls Miss Torso, the young life dancer, and she's topless in
yeah.
that opening shot. Her back is to you, but she's getting dressed, and she is topless.
Very risque.
Yeah, I couldn't actually believe that was in the movie.
I want to apologize if any of our listeners watched the movie and saw that woman's naked back and are horribly offended.
Yes, apologies. We might need to put an E rating on this particular. Have any of the episodes in the Christian Humanist Radio Network come with an E?
No, to be honest, I'm not sure how you get one, if you have to apply for one or not. There are definitely episodes of Sectarian Review where C. Derek Varn has said S. And there's been a couple of ours, but we usually bleep it. We have a bleep sound effect.
Oh, do you? And you,
so,
yeah.
No, we've That's never so gotten great. The E. But in some points, we may have deserved it. The other connection with voyeurism, the movie makes more or less explicit, is that the act of watching a movie is voyeuristic. So if you look at his window, it's the size and shape of a movie screen. Mm-hmm. And he's looking through it with this camera lens. I mean, so the director is a voyeur, the audience is a voyeur, and the whole enterprise, everything we're engaged in some sense, is like nothing more than looking out of a rear window at a bunch of people in their homes.
Yeah,
so any kind of condemnation you make is going to be a self-condemnation.
Yeah, that's great. That's so great.
Because we all look at Miss Torso take her top off too, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and so what is this fascination that we have with like the lives of others? Why is that tempting and fascinating and irresistible to us?
Because they're not us. They could be anyone or anything.
Say more, Jay.
I don't know. That's just the way that I think of it. I mean, it's that feeling that someone else has a different story, maybe a better story.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
There's something connected to social media there, don't you think? Facebook turns us all into voyeurs too. Everybody talks about the way that your Facebook face is constructed and curated, and we're only getting the parts of you that other people want to see. But isn't there a sense that when you scroll through Facebook, less so Twitter, but when you scroll through Facebook, or I assume Instagram, which I've never used, that you're doing something very similar to what Jeff is doing, only that everybody in the courtyard knows you're looking at them and is performing for you?
Mm. Of the two, I would say Instagram is more so than Facebook, simply because it's designed for sharing pictures and scenes and videos and things like that. Mm-hmm. I don't know about your particular Facebook feed, but mine is mainly text and things like that. I don't get a whole lot of pictures come through mine.
Mm-hmm. I get a fair number of pictures, but you're right. Instagram, I assume, doesn't have those bon mots that Facebook and Twitter have. So, yeah, I mean, I think there's a sense you spend all day looking into a screen now, right? I mean, we've all basically become Jeff, except we could get up and walk away if we wanted to. Mm-hmm. He's stuck there.
Yeah, the Instagram comparison is so interesting. I think there is something of the voyeurism driving our desire to sort of swipe, and you always just want to swipe one more, and like, oh, well, just one more. There's something voyeuristic about that. But obviously, you know, the biggest difference is that with Instagram, you are seeing people's public, presented, curated, molded face. It's like the face that they want everybody to see.
Thorwald's not going to kill his wife and put it on Instagram.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Well, for the most part, there are those who don't, that show you what it actually is. But I get what you're saying.
Yeah, and the thing I think that makes like true voyeurism, where people aren't presenting themselves, but you're the one sort of peering in, they're not letting you see, you're peering in, is then you see the private life, you know, you see the warts, you see the brokenness, and I think that's just irresistible for us, maybe in part because we can sort of sit in perverse judgment and kind of feel good about ourselves and our superiority. Maybe in some ways equally, I mean, sometimes there's certainly something titillating about it. Like, so when you see Miss Torso dancing around in her apartment, there's something titillating about that. We all understand that. But, and then equally maybe something comforting about the fact that we can see that other people are just as screwed up as we are.
Yeah, or worse.
Yeah.
Well, based on that description, the best place for social media voyeurism would be the comments section of any Facebook page.
That's not the best place for anything, except the best place to lose your faith in humanity.
But comments in general, because generally that's where you're going to see people bring in all of their frustration with everything mm-hmm. else. You know that most of the time they're not frustrated with whatever article they just read, necessarily. But it's a lot of other things that they're bringing in and decide to pile on all at once.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway. That's just my opinion.
I'm going to develop an app called Voyeurgram that just like periodically takes pictures randomly without you knowing about it and posts them to the web.
No, here's what you need. You need an app where people take pictures out of their window into somebody else's courtyard and just upload the pictures without telling them. I think I may have just described some sort of amateur porn site.
Yeah. I think people are already making money with that scheme.
The other thing is that Stella reminds him, I think, twice that just as he's looking out, anyone could just as easily be looking in, and it seems to shock him. Because, of course, when you become that eye, when you become the thing that's looking, you forget that, in fact, you're also a body and that, that you're not invisible. I mean, especially the technology of the day, he's not hiding behind a two-way or a, a one-way mirror.
Yeah.
One-way glass, two-way, I don't know. Whatever.
Yeah, and he certainly has his own private drama going on, as there's this woman who he likes a lot, but he doesn't want to marry, and they're constantly negotiating the boundaries of their relationship. At one point, there's that great scene where he basically explains to her why they can never get married because their worlds are too different, and then she leaves, or she's about to leave, and he's like, well, I'll see you tomorrow, right?
Yeah, right. Or, I mean, for that matter, the scene where she makes it clear that she's going to be staying the night with him, and this is a major social violation in 1954, and I people could be looking in at that, and who knows what they would think?
Yeah, well, that's exactly what Tom says, right? So when his friend Tom, the detective, comes, and he sees her little evening bag, right, with the slippers and the what do you call those things? Is it a negligee? Is it a...
I've never learned the difference in women's lingerie.
Come on, Michael. You're not fooling me.
I'm sorry. I think it's a negligee. I think that's right.
Well, anyways, and then he cracks and he says, well, do you tell your landlord everything that's going on here? Looking at the case, which is great.
Right, because the judgment goes both ways, right? He's standing in this window judging, but God only knows who's looking back in at him. None of them ever seem to, except for the pivotal scene at the end where Thorwald looks at him. And then things go straight to hell.
Yeah. And there's judgment, as it were, for his voyeurism.
The other thing about voyeurism that I think is important is that speech that the woman with the dog gives about how nobody knows anybody and the dog was the only one who cared about anyone, that is at odds with voyeurism, right? Because you can't look out the window at people you know. You're going to feel bad about it. So it's very important that he gets to make up these stories about them. And that's why he can give them names like Miss Lonely Hearts and Miss Torso. Mm-hmm. And Miss Hearing Aid, who is the woman who tries to give Thorwald gardening advice. Her name is Miss Hearing Aid. I don't think it's ever said in the movie.
Oh, is that right? But is that what it
is?
Yeah,
I think that's right.
Or in the credits?
Yeah, I don't know why she's called that. Or the composer, is that what he's called? The songwriter? The guy who can't write the song. Do you know who that is? That's Ross Bagsadarian, better known to everybody, I suppose, as David Seville of the Chipmunks. That's him.
Oh, is that right?
Isn't that weird?
The character in the movie, or the actor.
The actor who plays him is Roggs Bagsadarian.
Yeah, you know, so that's interesting. So we've talked a little bit about the proto-feminism in the movie, and we've talked a little bit about this big theme of voyeurism, but that whole dynamic of you know, how to describe it, like loneliness in the city. There is something really true. Like, you got to be really, really perverse to be like peeping on people who you know. Like, the thing that makes peeping fun, as it were, is that it's like strangers, right?
Tell me more, Ed. Tell me about what makes peeping fun.
So the other night, I was standing outside of Michael Farmer's window, and right? Isn't that right? Like, you don't peep on intimates, you peep on strangers. That's the whole fun of it.
And you can kind of create them, I suspect. I don't know. It's not like I've ever gone door to door. But I think we've all looked at people in the airport or, as you say, a coffee shop and kind of made up a story about them, right? And just as looking out that window with the camera is what being in a movie is about, making up stories about people you don't know is what writing a film is about, or a screenplay or a play or a novel or anything else. Like, in some ways, this is the entire human creative enterprise that he's involved in here. No wonder he can't give it up.
Yeah, so I live in a neighborhood next door to campus. It's a faculty neighborhood. So, you know, all of my neighbors are also my colleagues. And sometimes I'll be walking around the neighborhood at night and, you know, people's windows are open or whatever. And I avert my eyes. Like, there is just some... Yeah, and it's not even like my own self-righteousness. It's just kind of like, I don't want to know. Like, I really, really don't want to know. But maybe if it were strangers, I certainly wouldn't have, I mean, that just seems icky to me in a lot of ways.
Are you afraid you'll, like, look in and you'll see them dancing with their dog or something?
That would be the best case scenario.
Something that's not illegal or immoral, but would really make you dislike them.
I mean, yeah, it's an interesting experience in some ways living with your colleagues, because, like, you know, our back porch door will be open. I'll be like yelling at the kids or something like that, and like wondering.
Keeps you in line.
Yeah, if my neighbors think I'm some kind of horrible autocratic parent. But you know, in the city, so, like, that city social dynamic of people being intimate strangers with one another, right? So he doesn't know them. He doesn't want to know them. You kind of get the feeling that he feels superior to them. Mm-hmm. He's this big, adventurous photojournalist, a war hero, and all of that. And all of these people are beneath him. He doesn't want to get to know them, but he's fascinated by their lives. And the woman does give, like, the long speech about everybody being cold-hearted. People don't care about each other. The dog was the only one who liked everybody. That was why you killed him. That's what she says.
Yeah.
And so, you get this very interesting commentary on social relationships.
Yeah.
In the modern world, in urban settings.
And again, Miss Lonely Hearts is kind of the perfect emblem of this. We never see her interact with anyone during the heat wave except this one guy who attempts to assault her.
Yeah, the only time that people come together when there's some huge scandal, right? So
when the dog dies.
Yeah, when the dog dies, everybody comes out to the window and stares. Well, everybody but Thorwald, right?
Right.
And it's an incredible scene of him sitting in his darkened apartment, and all you can see is the glow of his cigar. So you know he's in there, but that he didn't come to the window, which was really quite amazing.
Yeah, what a brilliant shot.
Yep.
But then people come to the window when the dog dies because they want to see the spectacle. And people come to the window when Jeff is thrown out of his own window and the police show up and there's another big spectacle. But there's this kind of an alienation to city life that's characteristic of the movie, where people are living right on top of each other and are some ways extremely familiar with each other because everybody's peeping on everybody else, but then nobody really knows each other.
Mm-hmm.
And we could bring that right back around to our social media discussion.
Mm. Yeah, so, I mean, we could remake this movie in 2018. Except the dominant device wouldn't be windows in urban neighborhoods, but it would be social media.
Or we could call it Rear Windows. He uses a PC.
Oh, good lord.
Perfect. Spectacular.
Have you seen the remake with Christopher Reeve?
Actually, that was the first one that I saw. So when this came up, that's what I had in mind, and I hadn't seen the original. And I must say, I like the original a lot better.
I think they only made the other one so that Christopher Reeve could continue to work after his accident.
Maybe. I don't know. Having seen both, I like the resolution and the ending to the original much better than the remake.
I've not seen the remake. What happens?
Okay, so...
Spoiler alert.
I was going to say, spoiler. It's been several years since I've seen it, but I believe in the Christopher Reeve's remake, the killer is the artist... who actually puts the person they've killed in their sculpture.
Huh.
If I recall correctly.
Oh, they like encase the body.
Right, so...
That is out of a Dorothy Sayers short story.
Oh, is it really?
Yeah, I forget which one, but there's one there's one where that happens.
I might be getting that wrong because it's been a while since I've seen the movie, but I think that's how they ended it.
Well, at least they change the ending. Sometimes they remake a movie with a famous ending and then they just leave it, which is, like, why would anybody go see it? They also remade this, I don't know, 10 years ago as Disturbia, which I know nothing about except that it is very Rear Window.
Really? Because I remember seeing advertisements for it, but I didn't make the connection.
I am pretty sure that that movie is about like suburban voyeurism, and it would be interesting to see how the movie changes by being moved from an urban environment to a suburban environment.
Mm-hmm.
Because in suburbia, of course, you're kept apart from your neighbors, and yet suburbs are so built on envy.
Mm-hmm.
There is nothing quite like strolling through a suburb at night and looking in through the lit windows at other people's furniture.
I'll take your word for that.
You've never done that? Really? Am I the only one? I used to do it, and I would imagine, like, what would it be like to live in that house? Mm. Because, of course, you don't imagine that you would have your same furniture or your same crappy life. But, you know.
Look at that man dancing with his dog. Peculiar.
I haven't done that. I grew up in rural Pennsylvania, so there wasn't that opportunity, and I live in a smallish town in North Carolina now. The only time that I look in someone's window is at Christmas time when they've got it decorated.
Well, now I feel guilty. Thanks a lot, Jay.
Purposefully opened their curtains for us to look in.
Hey, if your curtains are open, you want people to look in. That's my feeling. I guess I am a voyeur. I don't really do it here, like across the street. I live in an apartment building that is across a parking lot from another apartment building. Maybe I should start. Maybe I'll see somebody kill his wife.
Why don't we wrap things up by just talking about the ending of the movie? The ending of the movie is pretty hopeful. I mean, maybe that's just a classic Hollywood happy ending. But let's see. Oh, so what happens at the end of the movie? We see a lot of reconciling of relationships.
Yep.
So earlier we see Miss Torso. She has these multiple suitors that she's bouncing out against each other at one point. The end of the movie closes. But I guess her long lost love has returned from the army. Right? That's how we're supposed to interpret that.
Stanley. He's this like little nebbishy guy.
Yeah. Yeah, and then she makes him like a ham sandwich, and so the Stanley, the undersized army corporal, comes home, and she embraces him with great passion and makes him a sandwich. Miss Lonely Hearts finds love, well, something like love, relationship with the pianist,
because his song saved her life.
At least she finds companionship, at the least.
Yes. But don't you think continued relationship is kind of implied in all of that?
Yeah, absolutely. They get a new dog. The people with the dog.
They get a new dog. What else happens?
The newlyweds do not have a happy ending.
Yes. They open their curtains.
He has lost his job, and I couldn't figure out if the idea was that he lost his job because he stayed home too many days to have sex with his wife, or if him losing his job was unrelated to their A story.
Yeah, so let's talk about them a little bit. But first, how did you get that he lost his job? I think that was lost on me.
Doesn't she say it? Doesn't she say, well, if I'd known you weren't going to have your job, we wouldn't have moved here? I think that's right. Uh-huh. Maybe I'm making it up.
No, that does sound familiar. So, you know, one of the themes running through the movie, obviously, is just themes about marriage. Jeff is, you know, is wrestling with the idea of marriage. Running parallel to that, he sees this newlywed couple. They are shown into the apartment by the landlord of the building. They go back out, and he carries her across the threshold. And they share a kiss, and they pull the blinds, and they do what newlyweds do, I guess. But it's kind of this idyllic, picture-perfect, of new marriage, of newlyweds. But then, you know, you see this slow, decay of their relationship. So eventually the blind comes up, and you can see him standing at the window. Maybe he's smoking or something like that, but he's clearly bedraggled and trying to get away from his wife. You know, is the implication that she's a kind of a sex maniac?
Yes.
Or is she just... Okay. So she's not just criticizing him or always... But the implication is that she is exhausting him physically.
Yeah. Yeah.
From what I was able to tell, and I was able to watch a short documentary on it, she was supposed to be like the nymphomaniac or something like that. Hmm. So she is written that way.
That's funny.
So speaking of feminist themes, that's interesting and unusual.
Female sexuality is often threatening in Hitchcock's movies. I mean, there's a lot of Hitchcock pioneers, not pioneers, but makes full use of the femme fatale. And I mean, there's a lot of kind of threatening female agency in Hitchcock. So this time it's played for laughs.
Yeah, his female leads are certainly, they are forces.
The Hitchcock blonde.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Well, there is the third married couple in the apartment. Aren't the couple that sleeps outside, aren't they married?
Yes.
You know, presumably, so in my viewing of it, I saw three different views. You have the newlyweds and what goes with that. You've got Torvald and the awful whatever end of a marriage, but then you've got the couple that's just making it work. They're sleeping outside on the fire escape. When it rains, they're trying to get stuff inside. Sometimes they succeed, sometimes they fail. They're just kind of there.
Apparently when Hitchcock shot that scene, so they're sleeping on the fire escape and it starts raining, all of the actors in the apartments opposite Jeff's apartment, they had earpieces, and Hitchcock would communicate with them through these radio earpieces. And apparently when they were doing that, he didn't tell them what he was doing, but he was giving them opposite. He's telling them to both to pull in the wrong direction so that it appeared particularly fumbly. And they shot it once, and he's like, that's perfect.
Yeah, that's great.
But yet...
And they break their alarm clock.
Yeah. But, so there's that theme of marriage. That's a nice way of thinking about it. You get these different portrayals of marriage. At the end, it all comes up roses, so the implication... Now, I was looking carefully if there was a ring on her finger at the end... And that last shot, there isn't. So they're not, Jeff and Lisa aren't married yet. But the implication is that they're going to be together, right? I guess just not enough time has passed for them to get married. He's in two casts. But she's sitting there. She's reading this book about the Himalayas, which apparently is a real book.
It is.
And so the implication there is that she has kind of crossed over into... his world. She has proved herself. She can live in his world. He falls asleep. She puts the book down and returns, as Michael mentioned earlier, back to her Harper Bazaar. So she's able to, she's proven that she can conquer his world while keeping her own. But the implication is that they're going to, you know, they're going to get married and live happily ever after. I don't know if there's any interesting kind of commentary there on marriage or whether that's just a happy Hollywood ending, but you certainly get a lot of interesting portrayals about marriage and the challenges of marriage in this movie.
Well, at the least, it's shown that even though Jeff has seen those three different kinds of marriage, he's still willing to do or have some kind of a relationship with Lisa.
Mm.
You know, whereas before he was pretty much all but get out.
Well, he's torn because he doesn't want to marry her, but he doesn't want to give her up, right? So he's like, we're not going to...
Because she's Grace Kelly circa 1954. Yeah,
very, very Grace Kelly. And he's like, well, we're not going to get married, but I'll see you tomorrow night, right?
The other thing about the ending that struck me is they're repainting the Torvald's apartment. And on the one hand, you can read that positively, because whatever it is that happened in there is now ancient history. But also, it made me think whether anybody's ever been killed in my apartment. You know what I mean? Like, we share these spaces. This everywhere you live, unless you built it yourself, has belonged to someone else before who did God knows what. You know, what amount of suffering or joy has gone in. Maybe just the act of living in spaces where other people have lived and continue to live, maybe that is itself voyeuristic, because we're always like butting into one another's lives.
I actually used to repaint apartments.
So what's the most disgusting thing you ever saw?
Pretty much a bathroom that had exploded and then had been left there for 3 weeks.
Oh. They didn't clean it up before you got there? Did you have to clean it?
I worked for a general contractor who contracted to basically go in after the tenants move out and do any work that needed to be done. So
that's foul. That's awful.
Well, yeah, paint covers a multitude of sins. Maybe that's one way to sort of symbolically interpret that. We superficially cover up all the yucky stuff. And
well, yeah, and so much of the movie is about the seedy underbelly of respectable life that I'm very interested in the fact that they bother to show the people repainting that apartment.
Yeah, it continues on with this theme of, like, public and private, the face that we present and the real interior us with all of its tragedies and perversions and all of that.
It could, or it could just be that they paint when tenants move out.
Yeah, well, there's that too.
It could be that simple, because that's, you know, not to be whatever, but that's just standard industry practice. You have tenants move out, you paint.
Well, sure, but they didn't have to show it. It cost them money to show it.
That's true, but since when was Hitchcock worried about money?
Yeah, I guess, suppose that's true.
And he's shown us everything else with the different residents. That's something that would have happened, so he would have shown it. I don't know. It's probably the deeper meaning, but it doesn't have to be. Sometimes paint is paint.
Fair enough.
Well, any other thoughts, gentlemen, on this classic of American cinema?
Overall, before they were live, I always try to tell Josh where the movie we're watching fits in at the theme parks, because I have been to them and he hasn't. So I will point out that Rear Window used to have an appearance at Universal Studios Florida, where you could, they had a giant reconstruction of the set, and you could look through binoculars at these different windows to try to spot the murder.
Oh, really? Is that?
I don't think it's there
anymore.
That's
too bad. I'm actually gonna be in Orlando this summer, and we'll be doing all that stuff. I'm sorry that is gonna be there. I would have made a point of trying to see it.
Yeah, it was. I remember enjoying it. I was 12 years old or whatever the last time I saw that. Oh, well.
You got to begin your voyeurism early.
Yeah. I definitely saw that before I'd seen the movie.
Well, gentlemen, it's been a pleasure talking about this great movie. Let me remind everybody that the City of Man are proud members of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Our press liaison is Kristen Filippik. You can learn more about our show or all of the other shows in the network by visiting christianhumanist.org. If you want to get in touch with the City of Man podcast specifically, check us out on Facebook at facebook.com/cityofmanpodcast. And as we always end this show, let me remind everybody to render unto Caesar those things that are Caesar's, and to render unto God those things that are God's.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. As I went a-walking that ribbon of high